Good evening and welcome. I'm Amna Nawaz. Judy Woodruff is away. On the NewsHour tonight, the aftermath. Hurricane Ian leaves behind massive damage and widespread power outages after tearing through Florida. We get the latest from on the ground. Then, draft dodging. Thousands of Russian men flee to neighboring countries to avoid fighting in Putin's war against Ukraine. And fish farming. Companies try to meet growing demand for seafood by raising and harvesting salmon on land, sparking pushback over sustainability and genetic engineering.
It does seem like an unlikely place to see thousands of salmon.
I would say most people would say it's unusual to see them in big tanks, but this is the future.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Hurricane Ian has moved on tonight after stamping an indelible mark of death and destruction across Florida. Local officials are reporting multiple people killed and hundreds of thousands more in the dark for days to come. Meanwhile, Ian has regained hurricane strength late today as it heads for landfall in South Carolina tomorrow. John Yang spent this day in St. Augustine, Florida, and begins our coverage.
Rescuers struggled to reach people stranded by the floodwaters that Ian left behind after raking the state overnight.
Are you guys okay?
By midday, more than 500 people had been rescued in hardest-hit southwest Florida. The efforts are hampered by flooded roads and damaged bridges. This is what's left of the only connection between Sanibel and Captiva Islands and Florida's Gulf Coast. In Naples, docks floated down the Gordon River and buildings were completely submerged. Boats now sit between buildings in Fort Myers near where Ian made landfall. Some parts of the city were under 3 or 4 feet of water, turning homes into islands and causing severe damage.
We got out the door, swam out the door as the water was here.
Officials are asking people to stay home and off the roads. With many areas still unreachable, President Biden warned the death toll could be significantly higher.
This could be the deadliest hurricane in Florida's history. The numbers are still unclear, but we're hearing early reports of what may be substantial loss of life.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
This is going to require years of effort to be able to rebuild and to come back. These are fantastic communities down in Southwest Florida. Of course, they didn't ask for this, but they need our help now.
Here we are, downtown Bonita, right after the storm, underwater.
Across the state, utility crews prepared for the long work of restoring power. At one point today, as many as 2.5 million customers were in the dark.
So have you stockpiled material here?
Yeah, so ahead of any storm, what we do is we gather the material that our crews, both in-state and out-of-state, are gonna need for the restoration process. So we've got anything from transformers, poles, wires, anything that needs to be used by our crews. As soon as they can get out there, they're coming.
Marshall Hastings is a spokesperson for Florida Power and Light, the state's biggest utility. Statewide, there are 21,000 workers ready to go, many of them from other power companies as far away as New Hampshire, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. In some places, the damage is so great that the task is more than simply restoring service.
We're going to have to rebuild, so that's going to mean extended outages for our customers. It takes about 24 hours post-landfall and post-clearing for us to really get a scope and idea of what the work is ahead of us.
Climate scientists say storms like Ian will be more common as warmer waters stir up more dangerous hurricanes. Hastings says the utility has worked to prepare Florida for this changing reality.
We've been on a journey of hardening the energy grid and in many cases undergrounding power lines for the last decade. And so as we rebuild it, we're ensuring the energy grid is as strong as it possibly can be to withstand hurricanes like this.
The storm is now heading out into the Atlantic and is forecast to make landfall again, this time in South Carolina, where residents are bracing for Ian's arrival tomorrow.
Utility officials say that some parts of the state may not have power for days, even weeks. That's because they're going to have to rebuild the power grid in areas where Ian left a deep, deep mark. Amna?
John, the damage sounds so extensive, particularly to that power system there. It's only been a day since the storm made landfall. So how are some of those earlier efforts to get out and restore power going so far?
Well, it takes a little while because they can't get out. Number one, some roads are blocked. They can't get to where the damage is and where the work is needed. But also, they can't get people up, workers up in what they call those buckets, you know, those buckets you see at the end of the articulated arms of utility trucks. They need the wind to be below 30 miles an hour in order to do that. And we're getting buffeted here. We're on the East Coast, the Atlantic coast of Florida. So the storm has already moved out to the Atlantic, but we're still being buffeted here by gusts up to 40 to 45 miles an hour. They hope, they believe that that tropical storm wind will die down, diminish overnight, and they can get out and be working full force tomorrow.
John, when the damage is so extensive and so widespread, we know they pre-positioned a lot of crews to try to address that power system failure early, but how do they prioritize where they're going?
Well, they've got about 37 of staging areas around the state, and the locations of those kept changing as the track of the storm kept changing. The utility for FPL has been working on this, planning for this storm, pre-planning for this storm for more than a week. So they've moved around those staging areas to where they anticipated that they'd be needed the most. Those staging areas are like camps, worker camps. They've got big tractor trailers outfitted with bunks for the workers to sleep in, big tents to feed them in, all to make their downtime more efficient and to maximize the time that they're out working once they can get out, once the winds die down, maximize their time trying to restore power.
We hope they're able to go out and do that safely as soon as possible. We hope you stay safe as well, John. That is John Yang reporting from St. Augustine, Florida, in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian. Thank you. The city of Venice, about an hour south of Tampa on Florida's west coast, avoided a direct hit but still took its share of damage. Nick Pesciotta is the vice mayor of Venice, and he joins me by phone now. Mr. Vice Mayor, thank you for joining us. Let's just start with what it looks like in your community right now. What do you see around you? What's the extent of the damage?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So basically, we have a lot of mobile home parks that have all have sustained some sort of damage. We have some single-family dwelling damage, a lot of standing water in the roadways, trees down, power lines down. Currently, our city's pretty much without power and without cell phone service. Airport has sustained damage, so it's pretty widespread.
Have you been able to visit your own home to see the damage?
Yes, I have been able to make contact with all of my family members as of about an hour ago, and fortunately, everyone is doing okay.
We're very glad to hear that. And I should mention, when Hurricane Ian came through, it was a Category 4 storm. You were there. Can you just tell us what it was like when the storm came through?
Very similar to what you hear on the news and see in many of the different coverage over the years of hurricanes. You know, we had very strong gusting winds. The walls were rattling. The windows were rattling. It was pretty intense. A lot of whistling, a lot of roaring sounds, and you know, a lot of different debris hitting the building and stuff like that.
Have you been through a hurricane in Florida before?
I've been through Hurricane Charlie back in 2004, which also hit this area. At that time, I experienced it when it hit Orlando, but I had deployed back to my hometown to see the devastation down in Punta Gorda.
How would you compare what Ian has brought to your community?
Believe it or not, for our town, we actually fared much better than those to the south of us, and that was very similar to Charlie. Venice was spared then, and I really do feel we dodged a bullet this time as well.
You did mention the mobile home communities there. Do you know if most people in your community were able to evacuate, or have you had to carry out any rescues?
We didn't have as many evacuations as we wanted, but we haven't had to do any rescues. We did have a mobile home structure fire this morning that pretty much engulfed about 10 mobile homes. Fortunately, those in those communities had evacuated, so we didn't have any fatalities. And so far, to my understanding, I think we've only had one injury reported from the storm.
Can I just ask you, Mr. Vice Mayor, what's it been like to walk around and to see your community this way? I know I've seen some pictures online of homes with their roofs blown off, a theater downtown that looks like it was just torn apart. What's it like for you to see that?
That's a very good point that you bring up is we're a historic community. We were kind of founded back in 1926, and our theater, it's the original from 1927. There's been some additions over time, but that entire stage is now gone. It's very devastating to see, but one thing I do love about our community is we have great public servants, and we have a very resilient community full of volunteers. I know that we'll withstand this test, and we will come back stronger.
We wish you all the best in those days, weeks, and months ahead. That is Vice Mayor of Venice, Florida, Nick Pesciotta, joining us on the phone. Thank you. Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
Now, let's get some more perspective on the scope of this storm, which has gathered strength and is classified as a hurricane once again. Jamie Rome is the acting director of the National Hurricane Center and joins me now. Jamie, welcome back to the NewsHour. Let's just start with what you can tell us at this hour about the storm's strength and its path right now.
Yeah, Ian has moved off the coast of Florida back over the waters of the Western Atlantic, I should say, and it's regained maximum sustained winds of 75 miles per hour, regained hurricane status, and this is why we have hurricane warnings along almost the entire coastal section of South Carolina and portions of North Carolina.
And what does that mean for the folks in the storm's path ahead? As we mentioned, it's headed to South Carolina. What does a storm like this mean for those folks?
It means that hurricane conditions are possible. And let's go to this next graphic, which shows that those winds can push inland. A lot of people forget that these winds can push inland. The blue area here is a tropical storm warning, which means tropical storm conditions are expected. Look how far inland it is. Raleigh and Columbia, South Carolina. So I really want people that are inland not to lower their guard with this one.
Jamie Rome, acting director of the National Hurricane Center, with the latest on Hurricane Ian. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, Wall Street came back to earth with a thud after Wednesday's one-day rally. Recession fears and rising interest rates sent major stock indices down by 1.5% to nearly 3%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 458 points to close at 29,225. The NASDAQ fell 314 points. The S&P 500 slipped 78. The latest financial data did little to help the mood of investors. Revised government figures confirmed that the U.S. economy shrank in the spring months for the second quarter in a row, and average 30-year mortgage rates hit 6.7%, the highest since the housing market crashed in the Great Recession. Britain's new Prime Minister, Liz Truss, defended her government's economic plan today. Last week, she announced billions of dollars in tax cuts for high earners without offsetting spending reductions. That sent the British pound plunging and jolted world markets. Today, Truss said she's doing what's needed to deal with soaring energy prices and sluggish growth.
It's a difficult time. We're facing a global economic crisis brought about by Putin's war in Ukraine. It was the right decision to take, and we need to continue to make sure we deliver the economic growth, we deliver the jobs and opportunities.
Later published reports said Truss will hold emergency budget talks tomorrow. A spending bill to keep the U.S. government running past tomorrow is a big step closer to final approval. The measure passed the Senate today and headed to the House of Representatives. It would avert a partial government shutdown and keep federal agencies running through mid-December. Virginia Ginni Thomas, wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, was questioned today by the Congressional January 6 committee. The committee chair said she stood by false claims that the 2020 presidential election results were fraudulent. The conservative activist arrived on Capitol Hill after months of negotiating with the committee. She was one of the last witnesses before the committee concludes its work. Russia has announced it will formally annex four occupied regions of Ukraine tomorrow. That follows a series of staged votes, which Ukraine and the West rejected as illegal. In Washington today, President Biden joined the chorus of condemnation.
The United States, I want to be very clear about this, the United States will never, never, never recognize Russia's claims on Ukraine's sovereign territory. This so-called referendum was a sham, an absolute sham.
Meanwhile, Ukraine's forces have reportedly gained ground around Lyman. The northeastern city lies within one of the regions being annexed. A fourth leak has been detected in the Nord Stream natural gas pipelines beneath the Baltic Sea. The Swedish Coast Guard released aerial video of the latest rupture today as natural gas bubbled up to the surface. The lines were built to carry Russian gas to Germany. Russia has denied sabotaging the lines to retaliate for Western support of Ukraine. Instead, today, Russian President Vladimir Putin called it, quote, international terrorism. The Supreme Court of India ruled today that all women have the right to an abortion up to 24 weeks of pregnancy. Under existing Indian law, single women could legally have abortions up to 20 weeks, but married women had up to 24 weeks. Abortion has been legal in India since 1971. Back in this country, six Republican-led states filed suit over President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. They said the administration overstepped its authority, and they argued that economic fallout from COVID-19 cannot justify the plan since Mr. Biden has said the pandemic is over. The administration plans to cancel up to $20,000 in education debt for millions of Americans. And the rapper known as Coolio, one of hip-hop's biggest names of the 1990s, has died. His manager says he passed away in Los Angeles on Wednesday. There is no word on the cause. Coolio won a Grammy for his 1995 hit Gangsta's Paradise from the movie soundtrack for Dangerous Minds. As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I take a look at my life and realize there's nothing left. Cause I've been blasting and laughing so long that even my mama thinks that my mind is gone. Coolio's legal name was artist Leon Ivey Jr. He was 59 years old. Still to come on the News Hour, how Democrats and Republicans are courting Latino voters ahead of the midterm elections. Oklahoma City works to reform its police force after Black Lives Matter protests. The New York Yankees' Aaron Judge ties the American League home run record and much more.
This is the PBS News Hour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin admitted, quote, mistakes in the mobilization of 300,000 Russians to fight in Ukraine. His announcement last week sparked an exodus of Russians fleeing across the border into Georgia, Finland, Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and elsewhere to avoid being conscripted. Despite a troubled history, Russia's neighbor Georgia has accepted the largest number of Russians. Nick Schifrin reports.
At the Upper Lars border checkpoint in Georgia, entire families are mobilizing themselves to escape Putin's mobilization. Relieved Russians arrive however they can, with their prized possessions, by whatever means necessary, to ride out of Russia rather than ride into the war in Ukraine. At one point, so many Russian cars arrived at this checkpoint, the miles-long line could be seen from space. Georgia has now restricted cars, so most of the Russians fleeing war walk with their wheels, at least as many as they can roll across. Aslan calls his uncle, overjoyed to have escaped.
Georgia.
To tell him he'd finally arrived after a 250-mile journey by bike, begun after Putin announced mobilization.
There's terrible traffic here, a sea of people. It's like a real zombie apocalypse.
He also called his mother, who had no idea about his planned escape.
People are moving towards here by foot, with baby strollers, dogs, bags, with whatever they can.
Ivan is a nuclear physicist against the war.
It's very wrong. It's awful. It's I can't comprehend how my fellow Russians can approve it.
Vyacheslav crossed with his girlfriend and friends and camping gear, just in case.
Everybody has different attitudes towards the war, but none of them want to take any part in it.
But he claims he didn't flee out of fear.
There is no panic in Russia, just some young people deciding to leave for a time. I think they are just trying to be careful and to look at things from different angles without taking any risks.
But panic there is. Videos posted online show Russians responding to mobilization with fear and loathing. One man lit a Molotov cocktail and torched a military recruitment post. In Siberia, another man shot a recruitment officer point blank. Some are so desperate to avoid mobilization, they ask their friends to purposely break their leg. Pain apparently worth bearing to avoid inflicting more pain on Ukraine. Moscow seems to have focused the mobilization in areas dominated by ethnic minorities. In mostly Muslim Dagestan, mothers clash with security officials. They chant, "No to war." And they plead with officials. "Why are you so calm?" she says. "Do you know where you are sending them?" They know their sons would be deployed unprepared. This recruit was on his way to occupied Ukraine with no training.
"On the 29th, we are being sent to Kherson. So think and decide for yourself what to do with this information going forward. No shooting, no theoretical training, nothing."
But in Russian-occupied Crimea, some cheer mobilization and answer its call. They may not be the best soldiers or the youngest, but Putin is determined to send hundreds of thousands to fill gaps in the front and possibly create new Russian units. And today, Putin admitted to mobilization mistakes and said they would be corrected.
"It is necessary to investigate each case separately. If a mistake has been made, it should be corrected, and those drafted unreasonably should return home."
Back at the Russia-Georgia border, 27-year-old Denis is constantly texting. He's waiting for his wife, who's still stuck on the other side of the border. They were traveling together when they hit a line of cars trying to escape. So he bought this bicycle out of fear that Putin might close the border at any minute.
"The hardest moment is now, because my wife is still on the other side and I am extremely worried about her whereabouts."
He joined thousands who rushed the border. He and many of these men claim no opinion on the war, but they say they don't want to be the ones fighting it.
"I try to be neutral towards this war and not to stand for Russia or Ukraine. I am just trying to live my life freely with my wife. It was a feeling of relief, a clear feeling of relief, that now everything has been left behind."
Thousands of Russians now walk to an uncertain future, having turned their backs on the war. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
There are at least 32 million eligible Latino voters in November's midterm elections, making them one of the fastest-growing sectors of the American electorate. Laura Barrón-López has more on the politics and issues driving these voters.
This year, Latino voters will be critical in deciding a number of key races that could determine the balance of power in Congress. For years, they have voted solidly Democratic, but the voting preferences of this diverse group are shifting. In 2020, President Biden won Hispanic voters by 21 points, down from Hillary Clinton in 2016, who won them by 38 points. To take a closer look at all this, I'm joined by Carlos Odio. He's the co-founder of Equis Research, a progressive polling firm that focuses on Latinos. And Mike Madrid. He's a Republican strategist and co-founder of the Lincoln Project. Thank you both for joining me today. Carlos, in 2020, a majority of Latinos voted for Democrats, but Republicans made noticeable gains in Texas, Florida, and at the margins in other swing states like Arizona and Nevada. Equis Research recently wrote that the Latino vote remains stuck in the 2020 moment. What is driving that?
That's right. And the shift really, Laura, is if there were 3 in 10 Latino voters who voted for Trump in 2016, it was closer to 4 in 10 in 2020. That seems small, but in this very hyper-polarized electorate where most people have chosen their sides, that ends up feeling seismic. Today, as you said, we are not seeing Democrats rebound among Latino voters, nor are we seeing their margins necessarily decrease. What we're seeing is a lot of Latino voters in limbo, and everything we see points to the role of the economy. They have concerns about the economy and Democrats' approach and handling of the economy and handling of other crises that have emerged over the last year. And yet Republicans haven't sealed the deal. And so still they're here on the fence, deciding which party they'll be with at the end of the day.
Mike, talking about Latinos that are in limbo, what issues could provide further opportunity for Republicans to persuade Latinos, particularly in states like Arizona and Nevada, where the Latino population, mostly of Mexican descent, as we know, is different than the population in Florida?
That's a great question. And again, most of the undecideds, that area that Carlos is correctly pointing out,
tends to be a Mexican-American vote. That's where about 80% of the competitive races in the country are dealing with that segment of the electorate. Look, the answer in brief is the economy. It's been the economy as a top issue for the past three decades. It continues to be. As the essential workforce in this country, it's overwhelmingly disproportionately impacting Latinos, whether it's inflation or whether it's job instability. Those are the concerns, those bread and butter issues that are driving the remaining segment of the electorate that Carlos is pointing out has not made a decision yet as we enter the final stretch of the midterms.
Mike, just very quickly, is there anything in addition to the economy, any other issue that you think Republicans could use to persuade Latinos?
Well, look, there's a really fascinating debate that's playing out in the Latino community. For Democrats, the abortion issue has decidedly moved Latinas, Hispanic women, back into the Democratic column, essentially blunting this rightward shift that was happening. But what you're seeing play out in the Rio Grande Valley, for example, and really throughout the Southwest, is the Republicans doubling down on this border security and this crime and law enforcement issue. Seems to be working in Texas, not as much in Arizona, but you do have other states that may not be border states with large migrant communities, like Nevada, a very contentious state, where the data is decidedly mixed, not just between the parties, but on the issues set. And so this complication of how we're approaching the vote in different states is really, I think, part of this American story that's really unfolding in a really rather unique way.
And on the issue of abortion, as well as gun policy, Democrats are favored by Latino voters. And a recent New York Times Siena poll found that 63% of Latinos oppose the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe versus Wade, compared to the 22% who support it. Carlos, could that Dobbs decision outweigh Latinos' concerns about the economy?
Well, look, here's the thing about abortion when it comes to Latino voters. First of all, there is this somehow a conventional wisdom in certain parts that Latinos are more socially conservative, perhaps on something like abortion. I don't think there's a lot of evidence of that, actually. What I will say is, if you ask an abortion question 1,000 different ways, you're going to get 1,000 different answers. And there is a lot of nuance. Where the nuance disappears is when it comes down to taking away rights. Well, like we see in the overturning of Roe v. Wade, in the Dobbs decision, in the action that now states are taking to strip away existing rights, what we are seeing is outright rejection across the Latino electorate, and especially among the swing voters, who are the ones who are going to tip this thing in critical states one way or the other. You see other issues like guns. Guns, again, can be very complicated. I will say Uvalde hit very personal way in Latino communities, and the importance, the salience of that issue rose to top three in most of our states and hasn't gone away. It isn't about, again, the intricacies of policy. At the end of the day, it's about who's going to protect me and my family. And there's a larger narrative there that can be told and that weaves into the economy and how people are thinking about insecurity in this moment.
I also want to get to the different facets of the Latino vote. Mike, you've said that generational and gender divides are becoming more pronounced among Latinos. Ahead of 2020, Equis found that young Latino men were drifting more towards former President Trump, while young Latinas are squarely with Democrats. Do you think that these divides are going to grow in November?
I think they may actually close a little bit because of the nature of the issue set that Carlos just brought up. But I think the long-term trend is absolutely going to play that out. I think he's exactly right. Generational divisions have almost always been the largest dividing line between Latino voters. How far we are removed from the immigrant experience says a lot about the way we identify ourselves as Americans with our own Hispanicity and the issue sets that we focus on. But there is also an extraordinarily large gender gap that is getting bigger. It's quite remarkable how big it is. And Latino culture, you know, despite the myth of machismo, we are and oftentimes a very feminized culture. And what I mean by that is we often look to women as leaders politically in our community, whether it's simply as community organizers or this really large number of Latinas, elected officials who literally officially take public policy positions on behalf of our community. There is a very big gap, and I would argue probably going to get bigger over time, between men and women in the Hispanic community.
And Carlos, there have been a record high number of migrants arriving at the U.S. southern border this year. I know Mike touched on the immigration issue, but how is that impacting races in states like Arizona and Nevada?
And, you know, immigration and the issue of immigration served for a very long time to help differentiate between the parties among Latino voters. It was a good, like, decade where really the Republican Party brand was defined by the rhetoric around an issue like immigration. We've seen that that's not the same right now, that actually some of the president's lowest approval ratings in this moment are on his handling of immigration. And that's because it's driven by essentially everybody, all Latinos on all sides of the issue. Really, there hasn't been a lot of action on immigration. And so what you see is, even among a set of Latinos who heavily favor a pathway to citizenship, want to see a humane and orderly system, they do have some concerns about the border, especially the border as it might be depicted in the media, not as a immigration issue, but as a law and order public safety concern. Are we handling yet another crisis that has emerged in the country? And so it is not the issue that it has been for Latinos in past elections. It's not going away. And there are different ways to talk about it. And the ways that, for example, Governor DeSantis is talking about immigration in recent weeks, the actions he has taken, put him squarely on the wrong side of that issue when it comes to Latinos. Because in his case, it's not about problem solving. It's not about public safety and order. It's really about humanity and cruelty and how do we treat those who've come to this country. And what does that mean about the ways that the United States welcomes Latinos, especially those who are fleeing difficult situations?
And Carlos, very quickly, I did want to ask you, there's been a lot of anxiety among pollsters about the accuracy of polls given the history of the past few cycles. So is it, are polls of Latinos, which is such a diverse, multifaceted group, actually reliable?
Well, that's a good question. I think the skepticism about polling is, obviously, it's hard to defend the profession in this point, at this point, given the recent track record. And yet, polling is a lot like weather reports, right? It is not about the exact accuracy, but directionally understanding the environment, understanding what we're headed into, understanding the range of scenarios that are possible. And so for all of its misses, at this point, the data is still helpful in kind of elucidating what are the concerns of voters, what is on their minds as they're making decisions at this point. It's what leads Mike and I to be talking about the role of the economy, because you see it coming up in poll after poll, in addition to focus groups and conversations that people are having at the doors or on the phones.
Carlos Odio, Mike Madrid, thank you for your time.
Now the second of a two-part look at efforts to create more sustainable fishing through what's known as aquaculture. As demand grows for seafood, the business of fish farming is growing, but controversy and concerns remain. Miles O'Brien reports.
If you build it, they will swim. Smack dab in the middle of a cornfield in Albany, Indiana, sits an impressive display of nature meeting human ingenuity. The crops are a long way from home.
Why the wash?
Biosecurity is absolutely critical because we have to protect the fish from anything that could harm them, like virus, pathogens, etc.
That's Sylvia Wolf, president and CEO of Aqua Bounty, a company focused on fish farming minus the ocean.
It does seem like an unlikely place to see thousands of salmon.
I would say most people would say it's unusual to see them in big tanks, but this is the future.
It's a completely enclosed fish farm. They produce 1,200 metric tons of salmon a year, moving them from tank to tank as they grow, swimming against currents of conventional wisdom.
We want to make sure that we're creating an affordable, healthy protein alternative so that more people can choose it.
This is salmon for the masses.
Salmon for the masses.
She walked me through the stages of growth.
These guys are 3 to 4 months old. They swim, they eat, they poop. That's what they
That's
do.
That's life.
That's life. So these guys have reached their harvest weight.
Uh-huh.
So they're going to be shipped to market. We're going to harvest them. They've been here, they've been in the farm for roughly 19-ish months.
That's about 6 to 8 months less than other Atlantic salmon. That's because these fish, all sterile females, are genetically engineered. 30 years ago, scientists spliced in a growth hormone gene from Pacific Chinook salmon, which are hardier, more voracious eaters. They also added a so-called promoter gene from ocean pout fish, which turns the growth gene on.
They eat and eat and eat, and so they grow faster, not larger, faster. But the other thing is they're incredibly efficient in the way that they process their feed into body mass. And so we actually can feed our fish less to get that accelerated growth rate.
In 2015, Aqua Bounty salmon became the first genetically modified animal approved for human consumption by the Food and Drug Administration. The government is requiring it be labeled bioengineered. But critics say regulators didn't require the company to do enough research. They are concerned eating the fish might cause unforeseen consequences to human health. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski is a strong critic.
We call this combination Frankenfish because it's just not right. It's just not right, and it disturbs me, quite honestly.
The FDA has mandated the salmon be raised in secure land-based facilities. Aqua Bounty has never reported an escape, but opponents of the GMO salmon are concerned they might harm wild fisheries. Indigenous fishers in Alaska are among activists calling for a boycott. Fawn Sharp is vice president of the Quinault Indian Nation.
The Quinault Nation opposes genetically engineered salmon because we believe very strongly that the salmon were gifted to our ancestors from the Creator. And when the Creator made and designed salmon, it was perfect. And for man to think that they could somehow modify it and make it better is very arrogant. It's not right.
The boycott campaign has worked. Many big food service companies and grocers are vowing not to sell Aqua Bounty salmon. So far, only two distributors have signed on.
The opposition is pretty loud, but it's what we call a very vocal minority. And what it does is it creates this uncertainty in the consumer's mind, but they're willing to listen.
Aqua Bounty is expanding despite the pushback. In April, the company broke ground on a $350 million full-scale production facility in Pioneer, Ohio, able to produce 10,000 metric tons of fish annually. The company is seeking a state permit to draw 5 million gallons a day from the aquifer.
Outside of North Central High School, a group of about a dozen protesters were making themselves heard today,
sparking opposition and a lot of local media coverage. Sylvia Wolf says Aqua Bounty has installed an elaborate water filtration and treatment system. She says the company releases only treated clean water back into rivers and creeks.
To the extent that water comes out of this facility, is it pretty clean?
It is. We have our own wastewater treatment facility in the back of the farm. So we're actually taking any water discharge, putting it through our wastewater treatment to make sure that as we discharge it, we also have settling ponds which continue to remove anything that we wouldn't want discharged into the creek or the river. And we're monitored very closely by Indiana EPA and the federal EPA.
Landlocked fish farming is energy intensive and expensive. Author and journalist Paul Greenberg has spent much of his career focused on the fishing industry.
It's very high energy costs to keep water at a constant temperature and keep that water circulating. All these kinds of things that nature does on its own in a tank-based situation, you have to pay for. So it's hard to make that profit margin work.
But demand for seafood is rising, and about 70% of the fish we eat in the U.S. is imported. When compared to fish flown in from Norway, Scotland, or Chile, the delivered cost of salmon raised on land might be on par. But can an indoor fish compete on taste? I asked Aqua Bounty to send me a sample.
Wow. They gave us the whole darn fish, didn't they?
My partner Susie cooked it up.
This looks like regular salmon?
Yeah, this looks like any Atlantic salmon that I would cook.
Okay.
And it passed the test.
The consistency is good. Smells great. It's delicious.
Seafood without the sea. It might be one way to help feed the planet, but it comes with a side of controversy and concern. It's definitely not a free lunch. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Albany, Indiana.
The killing of George Floyd in 2020 sparked nationwide Black Lives Matter protests and calls for police reform. Among America's large police departments, Oklahoma City ranked second in the country for the rate of people killed by officers. In March of this year, they began implementing major reforms. Communities correspondent Adam Kemp has been reporting on those changes. He joins me now. Adam, welcome back. It's good to see you. Let's start with some of those changes. What led to them in the first place, and where do they stand in terms of being implemented now?
Right. So like most of the country, following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Oklahoma City saw many nights of protests and demonstrations. For 10 straight nights, in fact, Oklahoma City activists stood outside of police headquarters and really demanded accountability for some of those stats that you mentioned, Domna. From there, Oklahoma City Mayor David Holt said he kind of recognized that a change was happening and needed to be made. So he gathered some local activists, some law enforcement officials, as well as city officials, and they had some meetings to really address police change and accountability here in Oklahoma. From there, they formed a task force and started a review of Oklahoma City Police with the help of an outside firm, 21CP Solutions, who they together crafted 39 recommendations, kind of focusing in on 8 areas of improvement for Oklahoma City Police. In March, they accepted those changes, like you said, and have already begun implementing several of those changes, including a dedicated response team for mental health crises. They've hired 47 new officers that are trained in crisis intervention, and they're in the process right now of hiring a mental health professional to work with Oklahoma City police officers as part of their, you know, daily units.
So, Adam, I have to ask, Oklahoma is a pretty conservative state, I think it's fair to say. A lot of these calls for police reform tend to move forward through more liberal areas. So how is it that the capital city was able to move forward with these reforms?
Right. Well, Oklahoma is definitely a right-leaning state. Mayor David Holt would tell you that Oklahoma City is pretty purple in its politics. He said people were very willing, police, activists, community leaders, to really come together and listen to each other. I spoke with Ganesha Martin of 21CP Solutions, who is kind of helping lead and checking in on Oklahoma City Police as these changes are being made. And she says that's often the hardest part, is taking that first step.
I do this work across the country, there are people who say they're going to do the work and then don't show up. What I have to say about Oklahoma City up to this point is they've been showing up. I think that where we are right now is very promising. I am excited about where we're going to go, and some of these things could even end up working towards being national best practices.
Adam, I heard her say there it's very promising. It's been 6 months since they started implementing the reforms. Is there any way to tell if it's working?
Right. After speaking with Martin, who, interestingly enough, worked in the city of Baltimore for the Baltimore Police Department and was served as the point person between the U.S. Justice Department and Baltimore Police in the investigation following Freddie Gray's death in 2015. She has a lot of experience seeing these changes get made in different areas of the country, and says that this change is slow and changes come in incremental kind of waves. She says she's seen a lot of promising things so far and is just now starting her initial review of Oklahoma City Police. Police say they are working diligently to make every change happen. Some other interesting changes from around the city that seem to be pointing in the right direction. Oklahoma City Council is accepting proposals right now for an alternative response team to 911 calls for those experiencing homelessness. And they just recently reestablished their Human Rights Commission to better hear citizen concerns.
And we know it's a story you are going to stick with ahead. That is our communities correspondent, Adam Kemp, reporting for us from Oklahoma City. Adam, thank you.
Thank you.
And you can read more of Adam's reporting on our website. That is pbs.org/newshour. It is turning into an historic September for Major League Baseball as two of the game's great hitters, Aaron Judge and Albert Pujols, are moving toward remarkable batting records. William Brangham catches us up.
Amna, this baseball season is going to be one for the record books. Yesterday, New York Yankee Aaron Judge hit his 61st home run of the season, tying the American League record set in 1961 by another Yankee, Roger Maris. Only five other players have hit the 60-homer mark, and Judge has six more regular season games to break Maris's record. And St. Louis Cardinal Albert Pujols, in what seemed to be the very twilight of his career, reached another rarefied milestone this week, hitting his 700th career home run. Only three other sluggers have ever reached that mark, and he's the only Latino player to do so. For more on these two remarkable talents, we turn to Jeff Passan, who covers baseball for ESPN. Jeff, thank you so much for being here. To Aaron Judge first, for those who don't follow baseball that closely, can you just put his accomplishments in perspective for us?
Aaron Judge burst on the scene with a 52-home run rookie season, and since then, he has been among the most tantalizing talents in the sport. He just hasn't been able to stay healthy for a full season. Well, he's healthy this year, and what he's doing is magnificent. When you watch Aaron Judge, you see a 6'7", 280-pound man who looks like he should be a defensive end in the NFL or a power forward in the NBA rather than roaming center field at Yankee Stadium. But he has tuned his swing to the point where all of that weight, all of that size translates to power. And he is the foremost and eminent power hitter in Major League Baseball these days. And because he's been on the field this year, he's been able to put together this year that's among the greatest in baseball history.
And he's not one of those sort of old school sluggers who hits a lot of home runs but also strikes out a lot. I mean, this is a guy that's got average, homers, RBIs. I mean, it's a remarkable package.
Yeah, and you just put out the three Triple Crown categories. Aaron Judge has a chance to win the Triple Crown this season. And to compound that with this American League record that he set this year, and to do all of this on the verge of reaching free agency, which he'll do this offseason, it's one of the more remarkable years we've seen in Major League Baseball in a long time.
Some of our viewers are going to remember, wait a minute, didn't Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa hit more than 60? We know that some of those guys, there were a lot of allegations and one admission of using performance-enhancing drugs in those gentlemen's career. How do we measure those men's accomplishments with what Judge is doing?
There are a few different ways you can look at it. Roger Maris Jr., the son of Roger Maris, who hit 61 home runs in 1961, believes that 61 is the record. And the problem with that thought, of course, is if you take it out logically and you start erasing records that Major League Baseball has in its record books, like Barry Bonds' 73 home runs, all of a sudden, the last time the Yankees won a World Series without a player who's been accused of using performance-enhancing drugs was 1978. So it's a Pandora's box that gets opened. And maybe it's an easier thing to do to just say that Barry Bonds hit a baseball over a fence 73 times in the 2001 season. But that's a fact. And that fact is irrefutable. And you end up with, I guess, warring factions of baseball purists who want to look at the record back when Roger Maris said it and say he did it clean, and baseball fans now who understand that sports is complicated and that depending on the era, there is always something different or something objectionable, and that Barry Bonds in the end is the one who's recognized by the league as being the single season and lifetime home run champion.
And let's turn then to Albert Pujols. He's a Hall of Fame legendary hitter, but a lot of baseball writers were really writing his baseball obituary. He was dropped by two teams and then re-signed by his old longtime team, the Cardinals, and now has this tremendous end of a career.
It's really a tremendous story. I think all of us in the industry, not just the baseball writing industry, but in front offices as well, saw this as a swan song for Albert Pujols, as a nice, tidy ending to a story of a career that started in St. Louis when he was 20 years old and went beyond anyone's wildest imagination. A kid who was a 13th round pick out of a junior college in Missouri turns into arguably the greatest right-handed hitter of all time. But the last decade or so of his career after he left St. Louis and went to the Los Angeles Angels wasn't particularly productive. A lot of injuries, a lot of problems, and they figured, you know, this is a nice tidy ending. Well, it turns out he's been one of the best hitters in the National League in the second half this season, helped give St. Louis the Central Division championship in the National League, and now he's going to be playing in the playoffs as he waltzes off into retirement with that beautiful round number of 700 in his baseball reference page.
And I think it is worth reminding people, again, who don't follow baseball that closely, that hitters today are facing a very different set of pitchers than the Ruths and Maris of the world.
Yeah, I was talking with someone earlier today, and I said Babe Ruth's performance-enhancing drug was 85-mile-an-hour fastballs. right now, what they're facing is the average fastball is 94 miles per hour. You regularly face 100-plus-mile-per-hour fastballs, and you see sliders that are going 93, 94, 95 miles per hour. The optimization of pitching is really a remarkable thing. And the fact that these hitters, Aaron Judge and Albert Pujols, especially among them, continue to do what they do in spite of that is one of the more beautiful things that we see in baseball on a daily basis these days.
Jeff Passett of ESPN, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Willie.
Well, last night, our own Judy Woodruff was honored with the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Emmys for News and had some words of wisdom to share as she accepted the honor.
In a moment when we are swimming in a sea of opinion, and thank God we can express opinion freely in this country, when our resources are stretched and when there is a raging debate over what's true and what isn't, we in journalism have to continue to do the hard work every day of reporting, double-checking, vetting, and confirming. We must get up every morning, put on our boots or our high heels, and resume the search for facts. It's not glamorous, it won't win us friends, but that's what our job is, and we cannot flag or grow weary. The American people are counting on us, our democracy depends on us, there is a lot of work to do. To the Academy, and to all of you, thank you so much.
An important reminder for all of us in journalism and a well-deserved award. Congratulations, Judy. On the NewsHour Online, meanwhile, for the first time in 75 years, the world's smallest and most endangered sea turtles have hatched on a tiny remote barrier island in Louisiana. We talked to scientists and environmentalists about this preservation victory. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you for joining us. We will see you soon.